Is there anybody who wishes to ask a question about what we have covered so far? Yes, Roger.
In Matthew 26, when you're covering the section about Christ, them trying to convict Christ of blasphemy, you know, Christ doesn't really answer the question directly. He says, henceforth you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power. And is Christ implying that he was the Messiah, but he didn't make a straight statement, so he couldn't be convicted? Or was it blasphemy by saying that the Son of Man was divine, or the Messiah, I mean, was divine?
No, the thing is this, is that it was something which was a common conception of the day, that this figure known as the Son of Man, based on the mention of him in Daniel, and then of course mention of him in some apocalyptic works, was either a semi-divine or a fully divine being, certainly a pre-existent being, who had been in heaven from either the beginning or at least time immemorial. And according to some of the scenarios, this Son of Man would come with great conquering power and would overcome the oppressors of Israel and the wicked, and would bring in the kingdom of God and the rule of God upon the earth. Now, to claim to be a pre-existent semi-divine being would be, in their eyes, a lie.
So
if he had said it and had used God's name, they would have found him guilty of blasphemy. Even though he would have been speaking the truth, they would not knowing it to be the truth, would have convicted him of blasphemy. And then they would have sentenced him to be stoned as Stephen was. And there would have been no reason to go to Pilate. However, by using the euphemism of power, he did not use God's name, and therefore he did not meet the legal justification for blasphemy. And what is taking place is not a condemnation of him for blasphemy, is a almost unanimous conclusion of all those present that anyone who makes such claims is worthy of what we are about to do to him. You see, which is to take him to Pilate, since we have not been able to prove blasphemy against him. Again, if they could have proved blasphemy, it would have been far more useful to them. Because although they would have been the ones responsible for organizing the execution, somebody convicted by the high court of blasphemy would have no following, you see. It would undercut that individual's following. So therefore, they would have preferred it. Because after all, they had to manipulate Pilate as it was to get a sentence, and they knew they'd have to. They knew they had no real case against Jesus. They knew that Pilate, left to his own devices, would not convict him. They were trying to avoid that because, at best, the result was uncertain. And if they took him to Pilate and tried to get a condemnation and failed, they'd be in a worse off position than before. Because then Jesus would be free and they would have been publicly humiliated. So they were very concerned about, you know, being able to pull that off. And as we'll see, they resorted to extreme pressure in order to do that.
So when they say, tell us whether you be the Christ, the Son of God, or Son of the Blessed, when they say Christ, they're referring to the Son of Man and not the Messiah.
No, they're referring to the Messiah. And by the way, that reminds me, the term Son of God, we mustn't read into it what we read into it, according to our fuller understanding. They had no understanding that the Messiah was to be literally God's Son, literally God in the flesh. They had absolutely no understanding of that particular point. Even today, the Jews reject that as anything to do with Messiah. In fact, if one engages in a discussion with a knowledgeable Jewish scholar or knowledgeable Jew on the point of Messiah, he'll say Jesus couldn't have been it because he claimed to be divine, and the Messiah is not supposed to be divine. He's purely a man. But they were using the term Son of God in the sense, you know, almost like Adam was a son of God because he was in a special relationship to him, or David, or Solomon is referred to as being the son, you know, where God speaking to David about the relationship that God would have with David's son Solomon, said that I will be to him a father and he shall be to me a son. That's the way they understood the term of the Messiah being the Son of God. And so they meant it in one specific sense, not the sense that, you know, we understand it, which of course is quite true, that he was literally the Son of God by being begotten by God's Spirit in Mary, and of course was a fully divine member of the divine family. Okay. Now, let us talk about the thing before Pilate.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. More questions. Yes.
Well, you see, there were all kinds of understandings in that day. Some people believed there would only be a Messiah, that the Son of Man figure was 6 months. Other people believed there would not be a Messiah. They would just be the Son of Man. But it was a fairly common idea that there would be a Messiah who would usher in a physical time of great blessing. And then the Son of Man would come. It would be sort of an outbreak of evil towards the end of that period of great blessing. Then the Son of Man would appear and would put down all evil, and there would become a spiritual existence, a new heaven, a new earth kind of thing, where everybody who survived would become some sort of spirit being. There would be no more fleshly beings left. And that's why in the handout idea that showed you how those two different scenarios had come to be blended before the time of Jesus, with the physical scenario being enacted before the spirit. Yes, yes. Now, later on, in an effort to sort of reclaim some, standing with the people, you might say, he decided he would do something nice. He would build an aqueduct, another one, to bring additional water into the city of Jerusalem for use, you know, in the temple services, because the existing aqueducts were bringing in water, of course. But the growth of the city of Jerusalem had put so much pressure on the water supply that they really didn't have enough. And so he decided he would bring in more water by building another aqueduct. Well, as is the case today, he had a problem of a cost overrun. The actual cost of construction was more than he had anticipated. And he didn't have the cash ready to hand to keep the project going. And so he reasoned within himself, well, the purpose of this aqueduct is really to help serve the temple, you know, and allow them to carry on their worship. And so he, using his authority, appropriated temple funds. I'm not talking about the private funds people kept in the temple. I'm talking about the temple tithe treasury to pay for it. And, of course, this created, again, a tremendous upsurge because it was not deemed that this would have been proper use of tithe money. And so again he was rebuked by the Romans for mishandling his situation in Judea. Now I think you can understand why the leadership feels at liberty to speak rather disrespectfully to him. He's sort of reeling and on the ropes as far as the Roman officials are concerned. And, you know, if they sent another complaint, they would undoubtedly be believed, because Pilate has already shown himself to have used poor judgment. So what is this in essence? It's a judgment call. Should the man have been condemned or not? And if the Jewish leaders send a report that say, look, we handed up somebody who was a ringleader of insurrection, and Pilate refused to convict him, the Roman officials under Caesar would look at that and say, oh, there he goes again. He's not using good judgment. I mean, if the Jewish leaders themselves were convinced that he was such a dangerous person, you know, how could he have erred in that? They would have swept aside his protestations, and he would have had it. Now, the matter of the double scourging, because John's account indicates he was scourged before he was finally handed over to be crucified, and Matthew's account says it wasn't until after he was handed over to be crucified that he was scourged. Do we just have a misplacement of the scourging, or do we have two actual separate scourgings? Well, I don't think that Matthew's account is wrong and John is right, and I don't think John is wrong and Matthew is right. We do have a double scourging. And the reason for it is given in John's account. Twice Pilate said, I will chastise him and release him. In other words, he's trying to strike a middle ground between full acquittal and full condemnation on the charge of treason, which would result in crucifixion. He is trying to find a middle ground. He says, let me punish him in this fashion. You see, there were two types of scourgings which were administered by the Romans. The first was a punishment in itself, and was a typical punishment administered for certain types of crimes. It was very similar to a related punishment, which was to be beaten with rods. Does that ring any bells? To be beaten with rods. Where did we read? Do we read about someone being beaten with rods by Roman officials? Paul. When Paul was accused of a crime in Philippi, even before he was tried, they administered the punishment, which was to beat him and his companion with rods. You see, that was a typical Roman. They believed that beatings were a good form of punishment because for medium-level crimes, a person was, you know, smarting after having been beaten about so badly, they would think twice about breaking laws again. You know, they could remember vividly, you know, what it felt like to be beaten. The same thing was true with this punishment of scourging. This was not the brutal kind of scourging that Jesus received later, which literally tore pieces of his flesh out. This was a more limited kind of scourging, you see, which was meant to be a punishment in itself. In other words, Pilate saying, look, he claims to be Messiah. I have examined the matter, and I don't see that kind of Messiah claim in him. But probably you're right. The people are too unsophisticated to distinguish the difference. He shouldn't be going shooting off his mouth maybe this way in such a careless way. So let me punish him for his carelessness, and let that be sufficient. Will you suffice that he has been judged guilty of being loose with his mouth in a very dangerous and sensitive area? We will punish him accordingly and then release him, and he will probably be wiser in the future and won't cause you problems. Will that sit all right with you? You see. But the Jewish leaders refuse to accept that. They want the full condemnation. And so finally, he is forced to do it. And traditionally, before crucifixion, people were scourged very badly. They were scourged very badly, not just to punish them additionally, but in part to practically numb them to a degree that the at least initial nailing up would not be quite as much of a shock to their systems. I mean, their bodies would be in a sort of a practically numb with pain by that time. And so therefore we find at the end of this section, when he released Barabbas and Jesus he delivered to be scourged and then crucified, we find the real extreme form of scourging. He was hoping that having scourged him the first time, they could look at him and see the man beaten with welts on him and say, okay, it's enough. He was trying to appeal to them, saying, look, you can see he's been punished. Isn't that enough? But it wasn't enough. They wanted the full punishment of death levied against him. And so prior to that crucifixion, he had, of course, to be scourged according to the usual procedure, the very vigorous kind of scourging. Okay. I would like to touch on one element which is mentioned in the text of Matthew before ending this section, and that is something which has been a matter of debate for centuries, indeed thousands of years. When Pilate washed his hands, and the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Did this represent a vow of a kind that God honored in any way, shape, and form? And is that somehow responsible for the sufferings of the Jews over the past, let's say, 2,000 years? And the answer is no. on several grounds. First of all, this is not the kind of a vow they could take. They can't bind their children in this kind of a fashion. Secondarily, the book of Acts itself says that while they shared in the guilt of it, those that were responsible for this action personally had guilt, as it says in Acts 2, verse 23, speaking about Jesus, him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain. Well, yes, they have a wicked and sinful part in it, the Jewish leaders, but it was also by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. The same point is made in Acts chapter 4, beginning in verse 27. For of a truth against your holy child Jesus, is speaking about God, whom you have anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, were gathered together for to do whatsoever your hand and your counsel determined before to be done. So Acts 4 says it's not just the Jewish leadership that shares in the sin and the guilt, but as it says here in Acts 4, Herod Antipas, Pontius Pilate, the Gentiles, and the people of Israel gathered together. In other words, the Jewish leadership also. Everyone shared in that guilt and blame. And finally, the most convincing point is this. How could a statement by these people assembled on this morning in the courtyard of Pilate's judgment seat be responsible for the sufferings of all the Jews for 2,000 years? It's ridiculous and illogical on the face of it. The number of Jews then existing in the world was probably about 5 million. The number of those living in Palestine numbered about 1.5 million. The numbers of those in Jerusalem were smaller yet. The numbers in the courtyard pronouncing this phrase were a tiny fraction of those. The idea that God would apply to all Jews everywhere whatever these people might have said is just illogical and beyond belief. Let alone, of course, the kind of vow it is just not the kind that God could honor, the binding of children for another person's actions in that fashion. Because sometimes it is used, even in some Protestant literature, as sort of a justification for Jewish suffering, and that's why I touch upon it, because it just doesn't make sense any which way you stack it up. Okay.